This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
Imagine for a moment a particle on the nanoscale, less than a thousandth of the width of a human hair, that operates with such precision that it can carry a medicine to a specific site in the body and release it just where it's needed, improving the drug's impact and reducing side effects. This idea has inspired and driven the research of my guest today. Ijoma Uchebu is Professor of Pharmaceutical Nanoscience at University College London. She uses the nanoparticles she's created to carry medicines to regions of the body that are notoriously hard to reach, the back of the eye and the brain. With clinical trials in the pipeline, her hope is to treat blindness with eye drops, transform pain relief, and address the opioid crisis. Ijoma grew up in the UK and in Nigeria and took an unconventional route to becoming a scientist. A single mother with three small children, trying to make ends meet, she might have given up on the idea. But she didn't. In fact, she's had an illustrious scientific career. And in October, she takes up the role of president of Wolfson College at Cambridge University. And her passion for science and sharing it with others is as strong as ever. She's even turned to stand-up comedy to help get her message across. Professor Ijoma Uchebu, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you very much, Jim, for having me.
Before we get into the science, I've got to ask you about your stand-up days. What drew you to comedy?
I actually decided that I wanted to be a better public speaker. So I had this role at UCL where I would welcome students that were coming from overseas. They were young, their first time away from home, and I wanted them to feel welcome. And I made a few jokes, and I noticed that when I made the jokes is when the students were really, really engaged. So I went for a comedy course, 10-week course.
Well, what was your act about?
The perils of getting older, but wanting to get down with the kids.
How did it go down?
So after you've done the comedy course, you do the Leicester Square Showcase. Speaking to 150 people about comedy I have written was terrifying. But once I got on and started to make jokes, dealt with a heckler, and the hecklers were my sisters-in-law, so I don't know why they were heckling. Once I dealt with the hecklers, I owned the place and I had a fabulous time. So fabulous that I decided to go to the Edinburgh Fringe. What I noticed was the next year when I did my address to the students, I had them rolling in the aisle.
What tricks did you learn?
When you stand in front of an audience, the way to make them laugh is to take them up one path and then suddenly veer off into a different direction. And that always gets a laugh.
Well, Ijoma Uchebu, let me take you back now. You were born in 1960 to parents who just arrived in the UK from Nigeria. So what brought them over?
So my parents came over by boat in February 1960, and they came over while my mother was pregnant for me. My mother was only 19. My father was about 30 years old. And really, they just came to be students.
They named you Ijoma, which I believe is to do with that journey that they took.
Precisely, yes. They named me Ijoma, which in Igbo language, which is the language of southeastern Nigeria, means have a nice trip.
Right.
So the name was sort of a hope for the future.
But not long after you were born, your parents paid for you to go into foster care as a very young baby. How did that come about?
My parents wanted to pursue their studies without having to worry about childcare, and private foster care was what West African parents did in those days. So they sent me to go and live with a white family in rural Kent. And I remember, you know, looking at photographs, it's just me, chubby black child, surrounded by a family of white faces. One thing I have to say is that I had a fabulous time living with this family. I have only positive memories of living with my Auntie Pat. I remember she used to wash me in the kitchen sink and I'd sort of hold onto the curtain and look out of the window and hope that I didn't go down the plug hole as she was washing me. So I had a wonderful time living with them. Then one day they were gone and my father was in their place, and there may have been tears. I don't know. Can't remember. But I do know that I never saw my Auntie Pat again.
this was the first 4 years of your life.
First 4 years of my life.
It's hard to imagine this today, to be honest, paying a stranger to look after your baby in what must have felt culturally very different to your parents having just arrived from Nigeria. How do you think about it now?
Of course, it's very strange now for us to do this. But I think in those days, you can imagine a lot is riding on this particular trip. And they probably trusted this family because in Nigeria, you do have an extended family. Mm. People look after people's children all the time.
Well, of course, we should say that while your experience was positive, that wasn't always the case.
Absolutely. And this is very tragic for those individuals, of course. And I was lucky that I didn't have that experience. I did know that I looked different. And I did remember thinking one day that I wonder if the palms of their hands and the soles of their feet are brown, because my palms are white and my soles are white. So I wonder if they have something similar.
The opposite.
The opposite. So I remember being very confused when I realised, well, actually, no, they didn't have that. But that was the only thing I can remember that made me realise that I must have felt different.
Well, as you mentioned, you spent the first 4 years of your life with Auntie Pat, after which you were returned to your father, your parents having sadly divorced by this point. What was it like living with your father?
My father had married again, and he had had two other children, and then he went on to have three other children. So then there were six of us. And living in our large family was wonderful because someone always had your back. So you weren't alone in the playground, for example.
And what about your mum, your biological mum?
I did meet her when I was about 13 years old. So I met her for about 2 weeks, and it was wonderful to get to know her a little bit. But then she sadly died.
That must have been tough for you, having spent only 2 weeks.
It was really hard at the time. But I remember because I didn't go to her funeral, I never believed she had died. So I sort of cloaked myself in this disbelief, believing that people were lying to me because they didn't want me to ask for her. So that was the thought I carried around for years until I finally one day realised, well, actually, she must be dead because I haven't seen her for a while.
Well, you were at secondary school at this point, having been the only child in your primary school class to get a place at the local grammar. Did you have any aspirations for a career in science back then?
Not in the slightest. I was thinking to myself, well, if I can leave school at 16, get a job in Woolworths and get paid, then I could buy some new clothes and have a nice time at weekends. And that was it.
But not long after this, in the early 70s, when you were 13, your father decided to move back to Nigeria with you and the rest of the family, to the small town of Owerri, close to where he was born. What was it like when you first arrived there?
Oh, it was hard, Jim, I must admit, because Nigeria had just come out of a civil war. The house we lived in had some shrapnel marks in it, and our secondary school had no running water and no electricity. And, you know, having to carry a bucket of water on your head, that was all new to me.
You also had a serious health problem, I gather, that first year.
I had an allergy to equatorial sun, so I was blistered all over. And I spent about 6 months in bed, and nobody knew what it was. So that took a while for me to sort of get used to the sun. And I never really got used to it. I was always on some kind of medication.
And yet, I gather the move to Nigeria turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to you.
It was because everybody around me in positions of authority looked just like me. And then I thought, OK, yes, I do not want to be a checkout girl.
But in the UK, you felt differently about this.
So in the UK, I didn't notice the absence of role models. And I remember, you know, sitting in lessons talking about the slave trade and seeing the diagrams of the ship's hold and people arranged, you know, really like cargo, and thinking, this has really got nothing to do with me. This is a long time ago in a place I've never been. And so I was in complete denial about my own curtailed ambition. And it was only when I got to Nigeria and saw a different reality that I began to realise that now I have this ambition because I can see what I couldn't imagine.
This ability to see a different reality, a different worldview. My father's from Iraq. I grew up in Iraq. My mother's English. So I always find holding two perspectives on the world actually quite useful, something that others don't have.
I think you're absolutely right.
Well, it was during secondary school that you began to take an interest in science, applying to study pharmacy at Benin University in Nigeria. But you didn't end up. wanting to be a pharmacist. So you did a master's in pharmaceutical chemistry at the University of Lagos. What was the focus of your work there?
So there I was looking at an antimalarial that everybody was taking that causes intense itching. Jim, you can claw yourself to bits trying to get at this itch. So the professor I was working with, he had a hypothesis that the itch was caused by the breakdown products of this drug. So my job was to fish out these breakdown products from patients' urine and see whether I could find a correlation between particular breakdown products and the itching. But it was incredibly difficult work to do. This was the 1980s in Nigeria when Nigeria's GDP had fallen about three quarters. Everything was in short supply. I would travel long distances to use a piece of equipment to analyse the compounds I had fished out of the patient's urine. And I'd get there and it would be out of order. And you'd open a bottle of ethanol and you'd smell methylated spirit. You couldn't do anything.
So how long did it take you to complete your master's?
About 6.5 years. It was really, really very hard.
Well, Ijeoma, this experience of being repeatedly held back as a scientist made you realise just how much you wanted to be one. But your personal circumstances threatened to get in the way.
Yes, at that time, I was also having three young children, a little baby, 15 months, and then my marriage was failing. And, you know, I spent a lot of time not doing science, but doing things to keep body and soul together, trying to get discount groceries. So in the end, I just wrote up my results and thought to myself, if I really want a research career, I would have to leave.
So what did you do?
Myself and my three children, we came to the UK. I had £500 in my pocket. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a university to go to. But I thought, it's probably going to be okay. Crazy!
So there you were, Gemma, back in the UK, and despite the personal challenges you faced, you were offered a place at London School of Pharmacy in 1991 to do a PhD in drug delivery using nanosystems. Now, maybe you can just give some background for listeners first. What are nanoparticles and why were they useful to you?
Nanoparticles are very small particles that are about a thousandth of the width of a human hair. When you take a medicine either by mouth as a tablet or you have an injection of a medicine, the medicine eventually finds its way into your bloodstream. And once it's in your bloodstream, it can go to all your organs. Now, sometimes you don't want the medicine to go to all your organs because not all of your organs are diseased. So what you can do is put the medicines into nanoparticles, and then you can control where the medicine goes. So then if these nanoparticles only go to the area where you have disease and not to healthy tissue, you're less likely to get side effects.
And so what was your PhD about then?
So my PhD was about trying to control the side effects associated with cancer chemotherapy, because these drugs go to all tissues and not only damage the cancer cells, but also damage the healthy cells. So what I wanted to do was to put these drugs in nanoparticles and steer them mostly to the cancer cells.
So what did you discover?
What I discovered is that I could do that. I could put the drug in these nanoparticles and get some of the drug to go to cancer cells. But I was making nanoparticles from a cluster of very small molecules. And the nanoparticles were not particularly stable.
So this cluster of molecules would carry chemo molecules inside them, but would drop some of them on the way to the target tissue.
Yes.
Let's put the science aside for a moment. You were doing your PhD while also looking after your three young children. And with little money, living in a B&B for the homeless, how did you manage?
That was a particularly hard time for our family. I was living in a bed and breakfast for the homeless, waiting for the council to house me. It had very few facilities. At one point, we had 11 families sharing one bathroom and one toilet, and we didn't have any privacy.
I mean, that time must have been so tough, but I also understand you kept your predicament quiet at work.
Yes. When I started my PhD, I had a fabulous supervisor, Professor Sandy Florence, but I was worried that if he knew I was a single mum, he would feel that I was completely not serious about getting a PhD. and he would hold that against me. I never mentioned my children. But then one day I went out to lunch with Sandy Florence and our sponsor. And I mentioned an anecdote that my daughter had relayed to me the night before. My supervisor was shocked and said, "You've got a daughter?" I said, "Yes, I've got more than one." And he said, "Well, where are they?" And I said, "Well, they live with me." And he was so surprised.
How long had you kept the secret?
I kept the secret for about a year. But you know what? Once he discovered, he was so supportive. If I had problems with my accommodation, he would write letters. He would phone people on my behalf. Mm. He paid me extra money so that I didn't have to go and take a third job. I mean, he did everything possible to make my studies smooth.
You got your PhD. And after that, you stayed on as a postdoc, as a researcher, working in various labs, keeping in mind the nanoparticle that you'd created during your PhD and trying to work out how you might improve it to make it more stable, more able to carry the drug without dropping some of it on the way. And then you had an idea.
Yes, my idea was quite simple. I thought instead of using a cluster of very small fatty molecules to make my nanoparticle, why don't I use a larger molecule, a polysaccharide? What would happen is that these larger molecules would be less likely to detach from the nanoparticle. And the way to think about it is to think about a ball of wool where the fibres are very short. So you can imagine that if the fibres are very short, they'd fall out, they'd scatter everywhere. But if you have longer fibres, polysaccharide, they'd all be entangled with each other and less likely to come apart. So I thought, OK, that might work.
I like the ball of wool analogy. The drug is then somehow trapped inside it.
The drug is trapped right in the middle, and you've got this entanglement of longer fibres. The drug's not going to fall out. So I remember drawing the molecule in my book and thinking, I'm not a chemist, but how can I synthesize it? So I really took some off-the-shelf chemistry tools and made this molecule and did find that when it makes nanoparticles, they're incredibly stable.
Well, your ideas about this nanoparticle started to take shape at Glasgow's University of Strathclyde, where you'd accepted a lectureship in drug delivery. This is in 1997. You became a professor there in 2002. What was the focus of your work then?
So what I was doing at Strathclyde was really examining what are the molecular characteristics that make these nanoparticles stable. And also, if I want to use them in medicines, what other attributes do I need? I discovered another attribute which I factored into these nanoparticles, and that's it's good if they're sticky, because then when they get to a cell surface, they'll spend a longer time there and you have a better chance of your drug going into the cell.
So stable so as not to fall apart, so that it could carry the drug to the target tissue, but sticky so that each nanoparticle could stick to a cell at the target site long enough for that nanoparticle to have time to disassemble and then release the drug where it was needed.
Yes, that's correct.
This was still being tested just on animals.
Absolutely. And we found that they were doing what we wanted them to do. And so we were really pleased.
Jem, I'd like to take a quick detour from the science, if I may, because not long after you moved up to Scotland, to Glasgow, you became pregnant with your fourth daughter. And Andreas, your partner, seized the opportunity to elope with you to Las Vegas.
We actually went to Las Vegas for a conference. I wanted to get married the moment I met Andreas. I thought he was incredibly cute. So I asked Andreas to marry me and he said no. And I asked him three times and he said no three times.
Wow.
And then as we were going to Las Vegas, he said, maybe we should get married. You know, Jim, I should have said no, but I said, yes, let's do that.
Too soft. And the connection with your now husband, Andreas Schatzlein, is also scientific because you collaborated with him when he was a researcher at Glasgow University.
That's right, yes. Andreas was looking at the biological behaviour of these nanoparticles while I was designing them. So we had a really nice collaboration going.
Well, you consolidated that collaboration in 2006 when you became Professor of Pharmaceutical Nanoscience at the London School of Pharmacy, now part of University College London, where Andreas also began to work. What was the focus of your research there?
So we had learnt a lot about these nanoparticles. We knew how they worked in animals, but we thought, well, now we would like to use them to make medicines to benefit patients. And so what we did is that we spun out the company Nanomerics And that moved the science from the academic arena into an arena where you could actually start making medicines for patients.
Well, one place you've been focusing on is the retina, the back of the eye, and on a treatment for age-related macular degeneration, a common cause of vision loss in older adults. First of all, how is this currently treated?
So at the moment, Jim, if you have a retinal disease of any description and there is a treatment for it, a lot of patients have an injection into the eyeball, as that is the only way you can get the drug close to the retina. They can only have these injections for about 2 years because you start to get damage to your eye. And we thought, well, what if we could make eye drops that would actually get the drug to the back of the eye, to the retina? And then that's what we created.
We should still stress this is still in animal studies. How effective is the nanoparticle in delivering the drug in animals?
Very effective. So we get enough drug to the retina to treat the condition.
You've also been looking into using the same nanoparticle to deliver drugs to the brain to help with pain relief. So what's wrong with the drugs we use already?
So people that have really severe pain are prescribed an opioid. And the opioids are either morphine or fentanyl, oxycodone. They are effective at reducing the pain, but they also have incredibly debilitating side effects. And they are addictive. In the UK, we have 40 deaths a week due to opioid poisoning. So these are effective drugs, but they have this huge side effect baggage. So what we decided is that we would take a molecule in everybody's brain called enkephalin. This molecule is released when you have a painful condition, but it doesn't last for very long. It's quickly degraded. And we thought, let's see if we can make that into a medicine. And we took this enkephalin, put it into nanoparticles. We fire it up to the top of the nose using a device. At the very top of our noses, we have nerve cells that help us smell. This is a gateway into the brain. And when we gave it through the nose to animals, we noticed that the animals had pain relief.
So what about trials in humans?
So what we're going to do this year is the safety trial to make sure that the nanoparticles are safe. In subsequent years, we will see whether the medicines actually work in the retina in humans, and we will see whether the medicines cause pain relief in humans.
Jim, I want to move on from nanotechnology. In 2015, you were appointed the UCL Provost's Envoy for Race Equality, where you steered the race agenda there for 5 years. You've mentioned how when you lived in Nigeria in your teens, it took seeing black people in powerful positions for you to develop your own internal sense of what you too could achieve. Is that what drew you to this role?
No, not at all, Jim. I mean, I was asked to come along and work on race equality by the provost. And I wasn't happy about it. Maybe they should ask management to sort it out. So I thought I would go to the meeting because I couldn't really say no to the provost. So I went along determined to just play around with my laptop and not really pay attention to what was going on. But as soon as I got into the meeting and I saw the data, I became evangelical. I actually asked the provost to give me a role. I was actually horrified.
What did it show?
You were less likely to be promoted if you were from an ethnic minority background. You were very much less likely to be promoted if you happened to be female and you happened to be black. If you were a black student or an ethnic minority student from an Asian or other background, you were less likely to get a first class or second class degree.
Despite, I presumably, coming in at the same level.
You're absolutely right. So people are coming in with the same qualifications, but graduating with different qualifications that you can see through a racial prism.
What did you do to address this in practice?
I started to think about how to make changes. But we did a number of things. But I think the pivotal thing we did was that we went to departments and faculties and said, your job is to add value to all the students, not just to some of the students. And so here are a menu of options that you can use. And they were things like, when you are in small group teaching, make sure that you ask the ethnic minority students to contribute. Don't shy away from asking them to contribute simply because you can't pronounce their name. In fact, ask them to pronounce their name again and again and again, because then they will feel that they belong in that group and they will contribute. The other thing is that when you're providing examples in order to illustrate certain concepts, look at ethnic minority scientists, look at women scientists, and bring all those examples in. Then we said, when it comes to your staff progression, if you're an ethnic minority member of staff with a degree, you could pair up with a senior member of staff, and that senior member of staff took you to meetings, introduced you to others. We also made sure that ethnic minority people sit on interview panels, but they were trained in employment law and good recruitment practice. So they offered not just their ethnic minority presence, but also knowledge about modern recruitment.
So what impact has this had then?
The impact has been phenomenal. More people from ethnic minority backgrounds that were recruited. We had more that were promoted. And then the awarding gap, first class or second class degree, was narrowed year on year in many faculties. And we got rid of the names of eugenicists from our buildings.
And that's something you're particularly proud of, isn't it?
I'm incredibly proud of that. We had at UCL prominent eugenicists. Their names decorated our buildings. These were people who were challenged in their day for their pseudoscience. And so I said to the provost, this is something we need to change. We had a 15-month inquiry. We took evidence from hundreds of people. And there was a big committee with some saying, we don't want to remove the names, this is history. And some saying, we have to because it's limiting our ability to deliver our mission. By the end of those 15 months, everybody agreed that the names had to be removed. And they were removed in June 2020.
And of course, it's not just about individuals. This benefits all of us.
Absolutely. If they're a diverse group of people, they make the best decisions. And when we talk about best decisions, we can look at things, for example, like pricing of stocks. There is evidence that says that if you're pricing stocks with a group of people from different backgrounds, they're more likely to price those stocks accurately. As all of us rely on the pricing of stocks for our pensions, that's good for everyone. Companies that have diverse boards tend to be more innovative, because if they have a diverse board and they are serving a multicultural audience, they're more likely to understand their customers. Even when it comes to juries, juries that are diverse tend to process the evidence more carefully. So living in a more equal society where people really have equity is beneficial for everyone.
Ijeoma Achebu, thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.
Thank you, Jim, for having me.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.